This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the first of a series on the thought of Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz, one of the leading Jewish thinkers of the 20th century. I am privileged to introduce Rabbi Rachel Berkovitz, who also happens to be the granddaughter of Rabbi Eliezer Berkovitz. Rachel teaches here at Pardes. She's been teaching here for 20 years about, teaching Talmud, teaching Halakha, teaching Mishnah. She's also a mechanechet, a faculty advisor to our students, a very beloved teacher here. She received her ordination last June from Rabbis Daniel Sperber and Herzl Hefter. She has been studying Talmud at various institutions, Hebrew University, Midrashat Lindenbaum, and also at the Hartman Institute. I won't say too much more, except I think that you're in for a real treat, and we'll give it over to Rachel.
Hi, I'm Rachel. It's a real pleasure to see you all here this evening. I hear an echo. Do you hear an echo?
No.
I'll just keep talking. I think for me, the real pleasure is that I know that my grandfather, towards the end of his life, felt as if he was not understood, marginalized, that people weren't ready to hear what he had to say. And I think in the almost 25 years since he passed away, there really has been, in some ways, a rebirth of the appreciation of his thought. And although clearly I can take no credit, I didn't happen to be lucky enough to be born to be his granddaughter, it's very heartwarming anytime I meet people who are interested in his philosophy, when I meet people who say, I've read his books and they changed my life. It's something very, very special, and I know that he would so appreciate to see a room filled with people who are interested in hearing his thoughts. So why give a little bit of more of an introduction?
Well, some of us here knew him.
Wow.
My wife and I lived in Chicago for his years there, and you were a student.
Wow. So in some ways, that's the second thing I was going to say. You might be luckier than I, in the sense that I'm standing here before you a little bit, you know, you put this picture of him and me, I was somewhat embarrassed by that, as his granddaughter. But to me, most of the time that he was alive, he was just my Saba, in the way that anyone has a Saba. I knew he wrote books, and we had them on our shelf, but I didn't really know what was in those books or what he had to say. He came to visit us on the Chagim, and we visited him, and we did things that grandparents and grandchildren do. And it was only towards the end of his life when I became a teenager and then at the beginning of my college career that I started to just begin to touch on reading his work and have a few conversations. I feel like it slipped away. I'm the oldest of my siblings, so I was lucky enough. So in some way I stand before you related, and I can tell you some personal things about him. In other ways, we're on the same page. You could read his work in the way I can and talk about it. So I wanted to put that out there where I'm coming from. There should be sword sheets going around. I'll just say a little bit of a short bio. I didn't know how to juggle this, in the sense that I want to spend the full time we have starting to talk about his philosophy. Are they coming? Are source sheets coming?
How many are missing?
Can you make some more? Yeah, thank you. For those who have the source sheet, there's just a very short bio in front of this, so you have a sense of where he lived and studied and taught. He was born in Transylvania. At one point when I was a little girl, I thought that was the most exciting thing I didn't know. Transylvania was a real place. Which was sometimes Romania, sometimes Hungary. And he studied in a number of sort of the yeshivot of that time period. He started out in Pressburg. He studied in the yeshiva in Frankfurt am Main of David Zvi Hoffman, but his sort of main association and where I think he sort of came into himself and really began to formalize his philosophy was in Berlin at the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, where he received his smicha from Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, who you might have heard of as the Sridei Eish, but the response of Rabbi Weinberg are called the Sridei Eish. The reason they're called the Sridei Eish, which means remnants of fire, is because the responsa that are published today are the bit of Rav Weinberg's responsa that survived the Shoah. And the reason they survived the Shoah is when my grandfather left, which is a whole other story of leaving Germany, which I won't tell you today, he begged Rav Weinberg to come with him. Rav Weinberg didn't want to leave, and he said, let me at least take some of your writings. So he got a big suitcase of his writings, and he brought them. He luckily left, was able, because he had a Romanian passport, he was able to go to the United Kingdom, to England. And I heard this from my grandmother. Seemingly every time during the Blitz of London, when they had to go down into the tube station, I don't know where my grandfather was. He must have been learning or at Schul. But my grandmother was schlepping the two little boys, my father and his uncle, plus the suitcase of the writings of Rav Weinberg. And when she told the story, she clearly was not so happy about that. But thanks to her and my grandfather, his writings have survived. And from Berlin, he was in England, as I said. And then after the war, the way we heard it in our family, the reason he went to Australia, because there were no quotas, and he wanted to get the remnants of his family that had survived the war out of Europe. At his shiva, we heard from someone else, I don't remember who told us this story, that one of the other reasons he had left England was that the community, the greater English community, wasn't so pleased with him. Apparently, he had been up for the job of chief rabbi of England, but they didn't like him politically because in his shul, when he said the prayer for it was then the king, right? They have this fancy, nice prayer that they say. He would always add in about the English government and monarchy, may they turn from their evil ways, because he did not like how Britain was acting in Palestine at that time, and they felt that this was not the makings of what someone who wanted to be the chief rabbi of England, and so someone explained that he was quietly asked to move on, but we always heard that he went to Australia for good reasons to get family members out, which he did. I have many relatives I do not know in Australia, and after he was in Australia for a while, he went to the States, and in the States he was in Boston for a number of years, in Blue Hill Avenue Shul in Dorchester, and then he went where he was sort of in his longest period to Chicago, where you knew him, and he was chair of the philosophy department, Jewish philosophy department at the Hebrew Theological Seminary, until he made Aliyah in 1976, where he lived to the end of his life, and he passed away in 1992. In the course of his life, he published 19 books in 3 different languages. He wrote them in the original. The first book he ever wrote was called Was ist der Talmud? What is the Talmud? Which he wrote in Germany. He once told me this story. I don't fully understand all the details of how it played out, but seemingly at the time, the Nazis were preparing their idea of having a museum or like a record of the Jewish people, and they commissioned someone to write a book explaining what the Talmud was. They actually went to Heschel apparently first, and Heschel recommended my grandfather to write the book, and that was his first book he ever wrote. We finally got it in German, and we had it translated. And then in England, clearly in America, he wrote books in English. When he moved to Israel, he wrote books in Hebrew, and even before, and he has written books on topics specifically in philosophy of halakha, on issues in halakha, and also in general Jewish philosophy. In this course of this 6-part lecture series, I was not sure which topics to do. I would say in some ways he's most well known for his Jewish philosophy on faith after the Holocaust. However, that is not anywhere close to my area of knowledge. And so there is not one of the 6 lectures on this, but to be honest to his work, anyone who wants to know fully about his philosophy should read this book and understand what he has to say about having faith after the Holocaust. That's topic number 1 that we will not be talking about together. I'm going to stick to my area that I feel comfortable with, which is understanding philosophy of halakha and issues that are related to that. The other area that I'm not going to discuss is another Jewish philosophy book called God, Man, and History. And I want to ask my grandfather, I don't remember exactly how I phrased it, like what his most important work was, or his favorite work, or something, and he said this book, which I'm not going to be speaking about, but I encourage you also to look at it for honesty's sake. What we're going to be doing together in the course of our short time together tonight, and then hopefully if I'm decent enough you'll return to the next five times, is tonight we're going to look a little bit at understanding his philosophy of halakha in the broad overview. And then we're going to take a number of different topics that are related to that. Next week we'll look at how that relates to his understanding of the status of women within halakha, particularly having to do with Jewish ritual. We're going to look at his views on conversion in halakha another night. We are going to look at his views on marriage and divorce. I actually didn't bring that book to hold up. I should. An entire book that he wrote in the 60s on trying to solve the problem of Agunot. We're going to try to understand what he suggests about conditional marriage and etc. We're going to have one on, on his thought of a Jewish sexual ethic, and one that's a little bit different on prayer. He wrote a whole small volume on prayer, so that's going to be our lesson. So that's our general overview. Okay? Ready to get started? Everyone okay? Okay. Feel free to ask me questions. I tend to talk fast because I feel like I want to try to get a lot in. Everyone should have this in front of you. So start on the first page. I took this as an excerpt, actually from the middle of, a lot of what we're going to do tonight is from this book called Not in Heaven, The Nature and Function of Halakha, which actually also has a Hebrew companion that is called Halakha Kocha V'Tafkida, which is sort of more in-depth halakha, and this, he then wrote this book in English afterwards, more for the layperson. And so a lot of the excerpts we're going to read are from this book, which I think has been reprinted with a different cover. So this is an excerpt for this book. This is what he says, and I think in this short paragraph you're going to get a lot of the main key points that are make up the bedrock of his philosophy. It says the following: I believe that we may say that halakha is the wisdom of the application of the written word of Torah to the life and history of the Jewish people. However, this wisdom and its interpretation cannot be contained in any book. No written word can deal in advance with innumerable situations, changes of circumstance, and new developments that normally occur in the history of men and nations. The eternal word of the Torah requires a time-related teaching in order to become effective in the life of the Jewish people. It was this tradition, passed on by the living word from generation to generation, as Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah, besides the Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah. So I think if you look at this, right, this is his definition of halakha. Maybe I should have asked you what you thought halakha was. I think a lot of people might say, oh, it's law. it's just a law system. Here he's very specific and he names a number of things. I don't know, he uses a lot of time-related words, right? He talks about history. He specifically says time-related teachings, right? He talks about new developments. He uses the word advance, yes? He has a sense of history, and that halakha is something that plays out throughout history. And it seems, I think, clear from already from this language that it's going to need to change, right? It's the application of the written word to specific life and specific situations. And he says explicitly that no written word can deal in advance with what's going to happen, right? We can't, in every possible permutation of what can play out in life and history, we can't have a set, fixed, written code for it. And so the fact that that we have something that is oral, that he talks about being passed down from generation to generation, we're going to get more of a sense of this, we're going to look at more, is his core understanding of halakha. The other interesting thing I think you see in this is he uses the word eternal. I've lost it. The eternal word of the Torah, right? So if I had said to you eternal, what is something that is eternal, right? I think that possibly some of us might have said it's unchanging, it's always the same, it exists continuously. But right in that same sentence of the eternal word of Torah, he says requires a time-related teaching. Right? And something that's a time-related teaching doesn't seem so eternal when you think about it, right? There's something for this moment, there's going to be something else for this moment, there's going to be something else for this moment. But for him, this is a very important idea. The idea that there's going to be truth to Torah and that it's going to be applicable to every single situation that the Jewish people faces throughout history means that there has to be different things said for different time periods, which in some ways seems a little bit maybe to our, I don't know where you're coming from, maybe this is fine with you, but when I first heard it, I was a little surprised because that wasn't exactly what I understood the word to be eternal to mean. If you flip the page, I couldn't resist, these two paragraphs are a little similar, but I think they're very important because he just clearly says what he thinks halakha is. This is actually from the very first page. It might actually be in the introduction. In this, where it says number one here, it says, I use the term halachic Judaism on the basis of my understanding of the meaning and function of halacha. Halacha is the bridge over which Torah moves from the written word into the living deed. Normally, there is a confrontation between the text, which is set, and life, which is forever in motion. How to face the confrontation between the text and actual life situation, how to resolve the problem arising from this confrontation, is the task of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law. This second Torah, ever since the days of Moses, handed down from generation to generation, accompanies the Torah Shebaktav, the written word, along its journey of realization in the innumerable concrete situations through which the Jewish people passes in the course of its history. It is the wisdom of Torah implementation in the daily life of the Jewish people. It renders Torah into Torah Chaim, living teaching and relevant law. The essence of the oral Torah is the halakha. As the root of the word indicates, haloch, to walk, to go. Halakha teaches the way along which a Jew is required to walk in accordance with the Torah. Halakha is the application of the Torah to life. But since there is no such thing as life in general, since it is always a certain form of life in a specific time of history, in a specific situation, Torah application means the application to a specific time in a specific situation. The result of this process I call halachic Judaism. And so this is, I think, essential, right? To me, this is a beautiful image of the bridge, right? Halacha is the bridge over which Torah moves from the written word into real life, right? And halacha is what takes something that is in a written text and turns it into what he calls Torah Chaim, something that is alive. But to do that, it has to be able to meet the needs of every specific situation that turns up, which is why, as we'll look at in these other evenings that we're going to spend together, right? He really immediately goes to whatever the core issues of the day. For him, the status of women was a main core issue. To me, it was always mind-boggling when I realized, like, he had three sons. He had no daughters. A lot of times you have people who get interested in an issue because people who are close to them, it pains them, it cures them. I think he really felt like this is something I see in the world at large that is going to be a problem in the modern world. Halacha has to say something about it. I see that the issue of conversion is breaking up the Jewish world with the different denominations. I have to say something about it. Because for him, for halacha to be eternal, to mean that it has truth and meaning for every time period, halacha has to have something to say for the needs of the day. How does halacha go about doing that? I'm going to try to give you some idea and a little window into his thought. So if real life is always changing and there are always new situations, and we say that there can't be one fixed text that's going to be able to tell us what to do, how do the halachic decisors know how to interact with a new situation, how to think about it, what principles to use? So right at the get-go of this book, he lays out sort of what he understands to be the principles and values that are art of the law. Here, if you read here on the page, now I'm on page two, it just says, there are no codes for specific situations. Halakha is the life of the Torah that renders decisions in the concrete situation in the spirit of principles and values that are the very heart of the law. So how does he know what those principles and values are? So I'm going to try, this clearly is a very broad and quick overview that I'm going to try to tell you. He lays out three main ones at the beginning. They are the idea of svara, of logic and common sense. I'm going to go more in depth in 1 second. They are the idea of what's feasible, what can actually happen and realistic for the life of the Jewish people, and what is ethical. Those are three main categories that are very important. So let's look at this specifically. In his summary, on page, source number three, I'm on page three now, source number three. He lays out four things that he thinks about svara, about common sense, right? Svara is that idea that is mentioned in the Gemara as a proof for something. Right? Sometimes we bring proofs from biblical texts. We quote a verse to bring a proof. And sometimes the Gemara says, that's logical. And so he examined all the different places. When I also thought about this afterwards, like he didn't have that nice Bar Ilan computer search. He like actually had to know all the different places that it mentions Svara, so he goes through them. He actually says a very lovely thing at the beginning of his work. He says that his philosophy of halacha, just wanted to read this one sentence to you, he said, he talks about how he was brought up in his father's house, what he acquired from Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, and he said, I was determined to be guided exclusively by the traditional halachic material as I have found it and as I have learned to understand it over the years. My ideology did not produce this work. The work fortified the ideology, which I think was very interesting. And what I think he tries to show you at the beginning of the book is he brings example after example, I'm going to give you some of them, of what he sees in the Talmud, of how they dealt with specific situations, and what the meta values and principles were behind them. And based on that, as a body, he creates a philosophy of what he understands the way halakha should function. So one of them is this common sense. And he lays down four main principles about it. So I'm on page 3, source 3. He says, principles from Svara, sound common sense, logical reasoning, have the validity of a biblical statement. So what does he mean by this? He brings a number of examples. I'll give you one of them. He says, there is a case where a woman shows up in town. She's new to the place. They didn't have like her Facebook page or her past history online. No one knows her. And she says to people, I was married, but now I'm divorced. And the question is, what should we believe? Should we believe what she says? Should we assume she's divorced? Should we assume she's married? And the rabbis debate this. They decide to say that they should believe her. And one of the rabbis tries to bring a biblical proof to believe this, to support this idea that we should believe her. And the other rabbis respond, why do you need a biblical proof? It's common sense. The mouth that forbid her is the mouth that permitted her, right? She said she was married, which is what you got all nervous. Maybe she's a married wife, a married woman, we can't. But then she also told you she was divorced. So when you're worried, you're not going to believe her on the divorce, but you're going to believe her on the married. If you're going to believe her on the married, you have to believe her on the divorce. That's logical, right? That's common sense. And so they reject the need. This is the part of bringing a biblical support. If you can prove something with common sense, you don't need a biblical text, which means that in some ways common sense is equal to a biblical text. In fact, they go to the extreme of if one of the rabbinim reads a verse and whatever he wants to learn out from the verse is something that could be learned from common sense, they say that can't possibly be the meaning from the verse. If I knew it from common sense, this verse must be coming to teach me something else. And so he says one of the values we learn is that the value of common sense has equal weight to biblical statements. Thing number two is, the Torah itself makes reference to, this is a little complicated, just bear with me. The Torah itself makes reference to ruling by a svara. It assumes it to be known, and by comparison to it, establishes its own ruling in a case which the svara on its own would not have been able to give the biblically required decision. I know that was a complicated sentence. I'm going to tell you the case that he's talking about. He went through all these cases, and then he was letting them up. We have a principle in halakha that mitzvot are, the Torah says, v'chai behem, you're supposed to live, right? We have a principle that says you don't have to give up your life to do mitzvot in general, right? So you don't have to martyr yourself to do mitzvot, except for the big three. There are three mitzvot that are yehareg v'al yavor, that you should give up your life and martyr yourself lest you transgress them, right? Those are, does anyone know what they are?
Idolatry.
Avodah zarah.
Murder.
Shufut avim.
Sexual
transgressions, gilui ariyot. So the Gemara in Sanhedrin is discussing this, and they say the following. How do we know that you can't give up, right? If someone comes to you with a gun at your head and says, I'm going to murder you unless you kill him, that you have to martyr yourself, that you can't go and kill him, right? This is a beautiful Gemara. If we had all the time in the world, I would have brought these Gemaras and we would learn them. And the answer is because who says your blood is redder than his? Meaning, if we value human life, we don't kill one human life to save another human life, Right? And it's just based on logic. There's no proof from the Torah. That is, if we value human life, it doesn't make sense to say, to save my life, I'll kill someone else. And therefore, you can't make that decision of whose blood is redder. And if someone's going to kill you, that's their problem. You're not going to kill somebody else. Right? That, the Gemara says, is established based on svara, based on common sense and logic. Then the Gemara goes to the case of sexual transgressions. And the Gemara says, the Torah compares the rape of an engaged woman, if you rape an engaged woman, I mean, compares it to as if you have killed her, right? It's actually we could have a whole class on the Torah comparing rape to a death of some sort, because you're allowed to, the attacker you're allowed to kill, the way you're allowed to kill someone who's self-defense, you're allowed to kill someone. Okay, so the Torah compares Gilui Ariot to Shfichut Damim, sexual transgression to murder, with a verse. They learn it from a verse. But then they say, how do I know, though, that I should martyr myself if someone says, I'm going to kill you, or unless you do the sexual transgression? Because the Torah, in a different area, compared the two, I'm now going to compare it to what we learned, that you have to martyr yourself with Shfichut Damim. I hope you follow this whole story. But it means that now we have something based on Svara. We have the Torah compare these two cases in a different halakha, but because the Torah compared these two cases, we now say, oh, the law should be, I also should martyr myself when it comes to sexual transgression. So that the way the rabbis understand it is, they use Torah's verses to support the idea to compare something to something we deduce logically. And we learn one from the other. Usually we say, I have a verse here and a verse here, and I can learn something from them. But what I'm saying is here, I have verses that say, it's compared to this thing that I have logic, and then I learn them as the same thing. So he's trying to show examples where the power of Svara is equal and comes from our Torah learning. So that's case number two. Case number three, a Svara can be so convincing that it may compel one's conscience, to suppress the plain meaning of a biblical injunction and force upon a verse in the Bible a meaning that can hardly bear textuality. Okay, let's understand what this means. Okay, he brings an example of this. I quoted the pasuk. Where did I write my sheet? In the Torah, it says, right, if a man divorces a woman, and then she goes and marries another man, a second husband, and then the second husband divorces her, she is not allowed to go back to the first husband. Okay? And in the Gemara, they have a discussion. What if the second union was not a union that was actually consummated by sexual action, but they were just engaged in the halakhic terminology, which is a stronger idea than us, like in modern types of engagement. And normally a woman needs a divorce, a get from that engagement. What if they were just engaged? Could she go back? Like, is that second union considered like a second marriage? And the rabbis decide, yes, it should be. Because in general, we think of halakhic engagement like a second marriage and other things, and that makes sense. But then they say, wait a second. If you look at the psukim in the Torah, which you don't have in front of you, and maybe I should put on the sources, but I will tell you. The Torah says the reason why she can't go back to the first husband. The Torah says, lo yachol ba'ala harishon asher shacha lashuv lakacharotah. The first husband that had sent her away, who divorced her the first time, can't go back and take her again to be his. Lo liisha, acharei asher hutma ki ta'ava ki lifnei Hashem, because she has been defiled and it is an abomination before God. Now, it seems that if we were just jumping in and looking at these verses, it seems to imply that this is something I would say about all marriages, right? First guy divorced, second guy divorced. Now she can't go back to the first guy. And it seems to imply that the fact that she had slept with a second man is called something defiling and is abomination. That it seems to be the simple meaning of the verses. And if we said that, then the case that I told you that was under discussion in the halakha doesn't make sense, because they just got engaged and they never consummated the marriage. But the rabbis say, they are so sort of morally bothered by the idea, why would you call a second marriage a defiling? It was legal, there was nothing wrong with it, right? Possibly, if we were maybe in biblical mindset and we thought that like women were property of men, you could possibly have that idea. But for the rabbis, they don't want that idea. So they reinterpret the biblical text to say that's only in the case where she was an adulteress. That's what it would mean she was defiled. right? They still think the halakha is she can't go back to the first husband. But they say it can't be, they use their svara. It can't be that just the second marriage is considered an abomination. It's legal. There's nothing wrong with it. And so they reread the simple meaning of the text based on their common sense. Does everyone understand what I'm saying? Right? Meaning, if we were honest, we'd say the text is talking about all types of marriages, second marriages. It doesn't say when she is an adulteress. Right? That's not the simple pshat reading of the text. But because the simple pshat reading of the text didn't meet with the rabbi's common sense, they are willing to reread the pshat meaning to something that doesn't fit the actual pshat. That's how powerful for them common sense is. So even though the Torah says she gets divorced, she marries another guy, she gets divorced, she can't go back to the first husband because it's as if the second marriage was somehow considered a defiling fact, they say no, second marriages aren't defiling. That can't be what the Torah means. That doesn't make sense to me. And they reread the text. Okay, so that was example number three. Right, all of these examples, the purposes are to show how powerful rabbis take the idea of common sense. Last one. It says the following. It says, a svara may show that in certain areas, the consequences of a generally prevailing law would be unacceptable, and therefore, that those cases must be exempt from the authority of the law. Right, so he says, I can have a rule, and based on svara, on common sense, I can say there's an exception to the rule. I don't need a verse to say there's an exception to the rule. I can just use my common sense. He brings another example. A lot of his examples, in general, for his philosophy of halakha, he learns from cases of marriage and divorce, which when we do our class on his views about marriage and divorce, I think he very much influenced his willingness to find leniencies and ways to deal with it, because I think he sees that model throughout halakha, even though today the way the halakha and the rabbinate deal with marriage and divorce does not seem so flexible. If you look back at some of the examples there are. So I'll say this example, this is the last example, and then we'll move on to the next type of thought. Here's the halakha. In the halakha, we have a principle that onus rachmana patre, if like an unforeseen event that you had no control over, a hurricane, something that God sends, causes you not to be able to do a mitzvah or not to be able to fill a religious act, you're exempt. We don't hold you responsible for things that are completely out of your control. That is a halakhic principle, which is a reasonable halakhic principle for human beings functioning in this world. However, in the case of a divorce, let's say a man is traveling across the seas, which in the time period of the Mishnah and the Gemara, you didn't know if he was ever going to return, you didn't know how long he was going to be away. And so sometimes husbands gave their wives conditional divorces that said something like, if I don't return in 30 days, you will be divorced, because they didn't want to leave her to be a chained wife and unable to be remarried.
Just like today.
So let's say he does that, right? He says, on condition that I return in 30 days, right? Let's say he really, really wants to come back. But there was a storm, there was a hurricane, the ship sank, and then he was shipwrecked, and he comes back after 35 days, right? Normally, we should say, we don't hold him responsible for this, and the halakha should still stand, that if he came back late due to unforeseen circumstances, she really should not be divorced, right? You understand? But then the halakha says, wait a second. If you knew when you got a conditional divorce that there might be some unforeseeable circumstances, that's why he didn't come back, depending on what type of woman you are, either if you were a nice, good Jewish halachic woman, you'd be the whole time worrying, maybe he still wants to come back, maybe he's trying to come back, and you'd stay an agunah, right? You would never accept the divorce to be final. And if you were a woman who might want to play around a little bit, you would say, he didn't come back, right? I got my divorce, I'm going to go have relationships with another person, but really he's going to come back tomorrow, and then you'll be an adulterous woman. So either way, this creates a situation, right, that it seems, from common sense, to be untenable. And so, what?
She would have the divorce, though.
Right, she's nice. Yeah, she's not an adulteress.
No, but if we say that if he got held up in a storm, he doesn't held responsible, so that condition is not a real condition, right? The halakha says, when things are unforeseeable, we don't hold you responsible for them. Right? There's a possibility that we could say that even though he didn't come back in 30 days, you came back after 32 days because the ship sank and he had to get another ship. He didn't want to divorce her, right? His intention was he didn't want it. That would be a thought. So Rava says, he says, no, it doesn't matter if he's on the other side of the river, jumping up and down, like, I'm here, I just got to cross the river and I'll be back in 30 days. But the ferry's on the other side. You know, it's beyond his control. He can't get across. We do not accept in this situation the premise that if things are beyond your control, you're not held responsible. You give a get and you say you're not coming back, it doesn't matter. If you show up 2 days later, past the deadline, you say, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean it, it does not matter. We do not accept the halakhic principle that is good in any other case, in this case. Because it doesn't make sense. It would lead, it's also linked to like thinking about human need, which is part of my essay. It would leave her in an untenable situation that it can't be logical that the halakha would want this, okay? So that is the last case of Svara. Which brings us into sort of the next area about what is feasible. What can we expect human beings to bear? And there is an assumption based on a Talmudic principle, right? The Gemara itself says, Hecha de'efshar, efshar, hecha de'lo'efshar, lo'efshar. Where it is possible, where it's not possible, it's not possible. I know that's but what it means is, he says, the Torah was not given to ministering angels of the Almighty, right? That's self-understood, right? A number of halakhic rulings are based on this insight. But if so, the Torah must pay attention to human nature, to human condition, and to human needs. Right? So this is essential. There is an understanding that like what humans can bear and what is new, like acceptable expectations is going to be a relevant halakhic deciding factor. And here, I'm worried about my time. I'll give you a few examples. One of his main ones is Eshet Yafat Torah, the idea that if you have a war and you capture booty and you capture captive and you are attracted, it's not on the page, you are attracted to a woman and want to marry her, you have to go through a particular ritual. You have to shave her head, you have to let her mourn for 30 days, and then you marry her. So the Gemara asks, like, why not just forbid it? Why allow it? Right? This non-Jewish woman that you're bringing her has, why? He says, yeah, sure. It's impossible to expect that of human beings. I don't know what you think of human beings. People have Yetzihara. They wouldn't be able to stand that. And since human beings are going to need to do this, the halakha needs to find a way for them to do that. I don't know if you like that case. I'll give you a different case. Here, this is a good case. Two good cases. Here, like this. Another case of get. A man goes, he's far away, he's old, he's sick, and he's worried that he's going to die and they don't have any children, and she's going to be required to do levirate marriage. And he wants to free her of this. So he sends a messenger with a divorce get. And the question is, if he were to die before the messenger gets her, the get would be invalid, and she'd have to go through the levirate marriage or the chalitza, and she'd be like she's married or bound to this other man, the brother, until she undoes it and wouldn't be able to marry someone else. So in that situation, we say, we don't try to find out if he's still alive. We don't do anything. The second the shaliach comes, the messenger comes, we assume he's alive and the get is good. That's case number one. In a different case, where a kohen, not in that similar situation, a kohen says, he gives a conditional get to his wife, and he says to her, this get will be good right before I die. Okay? In that case, they say you always have to worry that it's soon that he's gonna die and you'll be divorced, and she has to stop eating truma. Because she's married to the Kohen, she's allowed to eat the special ties. But if she wasn't married to the Kohen, she wouldn't be allowed to eat them. And there they act as if we think he died, and we act as if, so the halachas, the Gemara says, well, like, why, these two seem to be the same case. A get, a conditional get, a get sent. In one case, we say, oh, no, he didn't die at all. In the other case, we gotta worry all the time that he died. Why? And the Gemara says, because with truma, eshar, right? You can say to a woman, eat regular food, don't eat truma. Like, that's a reasonable request that you can make of her. But to say to her, like, you might end up being, like, he might be dead, he might not be dead, he's off, far off, and you don't know, you're leaving her in aguna. She doesn't know. Can she remarry? Can she remarry? Does she have to do yibum with the brother or not? That's an untenable, eshar, to leave a woman like that. And so they take the same, in some ways, premise, but they decide two different things depending on the situation, because what they think is reasonable to expect for human nature. I'll say one more case of this, because I think this is a good one. It's a little, you have to, it's bear with me of the a little bit the complicated. It's also about levirate marriage and chalitza. Okay? If a couple, if the husband passed away and they don't have a child, she's going to be required to do levirate marriage. If she had a child who then died, like was born, God forbid, and then died immediately, she's exempt from doing levirate marriage. What if she has a child preterm? Do we consider that to be like a real child was born, or do we consider it to be like a miscarriage? Okay, and the halakha debates the concept in for a lot of other things of like, what about a child that's born preterm? And Rabbi, I think it's Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel said, this child has to wait, we have to live for 30 days for us to consider it bar kayama, that it's considered a live, healthy birth, and only then would we know she would be exempt from doing levirate marriage. And then they say a very interesting thing. If the husband's died, right? You understand, the husband's dead, now she wants to remarry. And the question is, can she remarry, or is she bound to his brother, right? Right? Nope. Right? She's had this preterm baby. You lost it?
No, I had nothing to do with this situation.
You lost it? The answer is so good. Maybe you think I'm crazy. I don't know. Listen to the case again. The case is, if a couple was married and God forbid they had a child that died immediately, she would be, and he died, she would be free to, she'd be free to marriage, and she wouldn't be bound to his brother in some way. Okay, and we want her to be able to remarry. She's had a tragedy. Her husband's died, her baby's died. We want her to be remarried. But what if the baby that died was born early and was a preterm? I don't know what anyone, I hope this is not a trigger moment for people. That is a very upsetting situation, I admit. But do we consider it as if she had a live birth that would exempt her from having to be related to his brother and free to marry? Okay, so the halakha says the following. If she's going to be marrying a Yisrael, the second person she wants, we would require her to try to, and the baby had died before. We're going to hold like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel that really it needed to live for 30 days, and we would require her to do yibum, or chalitza. But if she wants to marry a kohen, maybe this is way too complicated. I didn't think it was so complicated. Yeah. She won't be able to marry a kohen. Kohens are not allowed to marry divorcees. Difficult halakha that we're not discussing. Kohens are not allowed to marry people who have also had a chalitza ceremony. It's like being rejected or being divorced. She wouldn't be able to marry him. So if she's going to marry a kohen, then we don't hold like Rabbi Gamliel. We say that a preterm birth is a birth, and she's free from chalitza. Do you understand? All you need to understand is they decide whether if she's going to be married to a kohen, this whole thing would say you can't marry him. And they say that's untenable to say that. And so they decide halacha in one way. If she was going to marry Yisrael, then we could apply this halacha. It would be okay. And we could decide halacha in another way. Whoa, Rachel, when you give this lecture again, do not give that example. To me, the example's a great example, though. Because it says, she wants to marry the Kohen. We can't stop her. It would be impossible to apply this halacha. That's all you need to know in the bottom line. That the human need is decisive, right? Humans, what's feasible and what is human nature and what is human need affects the halakha. Maybe that was a bad example. I hope you understood that. I'll say some other things, because this is the concept is so important. Here, flip the page. I'll read it here. I brought this one because it's timely. It talks about adding an extra udder. Month of Adar. So you thought that we incalculate the calendar because we just don't want Pesach to not be in the spring. But listen to this. It says, a careful examination of the examples discussed will show that the application of the principles, I'm on page 4, show that the application of the principle of the possible, the impossible is not objectively impossible. But that which is not reasonably feasible, right? When we say something's impossible, it's not that you could do it. It's just not reasonably feasible. The category of Efshar, the possible, represents what in view of human nature and with proper attention to human needs is practically or morally feasible. Illustrations of pragmatic and moral feasibility are found in certain rules that were to be observed in the calculation of the annual calendar. Because of the difference between the solar and lunar years, it is necessary in certain sequences of a cycle to add additional months, a second Adar, to the Jewish year. Apart from this, occasionally a second Adar was inserted for purely practical reasons, which had nothing to do with planetary order. And so it was taught. This is a Gemara in Sanhedrin. One introduces the additional month because of the roads, because of the bridges, because of the ovens for roasting the Paschal lamb, and because of Jews who have left their homes in exile with the intention of going to Jerusalem to celebrate Pesach there, but have not arrived yet. Because the winter rains and roads to Jerusalem were washed out, bridges were carried away by floods, and ovens were damaged. It was, of course, a practical necessity to postpone the celebration of Passover by 1 month, so that the necessary repairs might be made. Most significant, however, is the postponement in order not to disappoint travelers from Babylon who were on their way to celebrate the festival in Jerusalem, but had been delayed for whatever reason. The second Adar was added to the annual cycle of that year in order to enable them to arrive. The entire sequence of the year's holy days was thus moved by 1 month because of the consideration of their feelings. To do anything else would have been lo efshar, impossible, because it would have been morally not feasible. I know this doesn't fit with anything you understand about halakha, but this is what the text is saying, that we sometimes are going to move the date of Pesach because people aren't here yet and the bridge is broken and we got to fix it. And it would be, can you imagine if they all showed up and they missed it? They traveled all the way from Babylon? That's impossible. We can't let them miss it, right? We have to change it. Right? And so this is another example of, it's not that it's physically impossible, but that we take into concern human feeling and human need when deciding halakha. All right.
But doesn't Pesach training come to accommodate that possibility?
But can you imagine if you traveled all the way from Babylonia and you were coming to spend 7 days of Pesach in Yerushalayim, and then they said, oh, you missed it, but you can come for this like one day, like you do your Pesach sacrifice, right? It shows that it's not just about doing the mitzvah. This is what the text says, right? We take their feelings into account, that they've come, and that we want them to make it. I don't have another answer, right? It's about how would they feel? What can we expect of them, right? There's this thing. The traveling is difficult. We know what this weather is like. Now it's sunny, right? They didn't have beautiful paved roads that we had. They don't have airplanes. These are practical concerns and the needs of the Jewish people. And we take them into account when deciding the halakha. That's what the text said. Yes?
It just makes it a kavachomer that they choose this because there is a Pesach Sheni. So you could reasonably say, hey, look, too bad, the road was washed out, but yeah, there's a Pesach Sheni. But because of the feelings, now it's almost purely an aesthetic issue.
Nahum. Right. You might have thought this mitzvah was so important, but your point that they could have done the mitzvah, but yet we still say this just about how do they feel? Like, basically, your shrine needs some repair is a reason. Like, we're not ready to get this influx. The roads are out, so we got to postpone this. And all the more so, like, these poor people are not going to make it on time, so we have to postpone it. Like, the feelings of the Jewish people as the need of the nation become important. I don't want to keep us here long, so I'm going to try to go a little quicker. I love the texts, but maybe I got too excited about them. I didn't bring you any quotes about the ethical. I know that seems sad. And to me, the idea that sometimes halacha acts ethically, and that being ethical is a value, to a certain extent, was something that is less foreign to us. He quotes numerous examples that we do things for Darchei Shalom, that the Torah's ways are pleasantly, that you should walk in the path of the right and the just. And he brings as numeral, by the way, those examples I brought you were like, I picked one example. I thought they were the good ones. I thought they were the juicy ones, but apparently they were complicated ones. But he does the same thing with this. He brings numerous examples of ethical. I'll say one, because it's also with marriage and divorce. He says, you can make a conditional marriage. Halachically, it works. I'll marry you on condition that X, Y, and Z happens. So one of the conditions you could say to a woman, I'll marry you on the condition that your husband dies. That is considered a halachically good marriage. Or you could say, a man's not supposed to marry two sisters. So you could say, you're married to sister one, and you could say to sister two, I'll marry you on condition that my current wife dies. Those are Torahly considered good marriages. But the halacha says, that is not a way you should behave. Right? That does not foster shalom in the world between husband and wife. Whatever. And they say, even though legally according to the Torah that would work, we do not accept, you're not allowed to do that. It's just ethically inappropriate behavior. So that's like a small example, but there are numerous, numerous examples. Okay, next thing that I want to talk about. Now that he set out all these principles, 4 or 5, we're on page 5, there's one more thing that is very, very important to him in describing what is, like, how does halakha play out. And this is also links to this idea that we're going to see him talk about a bit more, in that there should be no codes for, there can't be codes for specific situations. And so he says the following on page 5, source 6. This is actually from an essay he wrote in Halakha. Not that exciting to show you the cover, Crisis of Faith. And it says the following. A specific aware of God is controlled by a more comprehensive divine command. Therein lies the secret of the creative vitality of Halakha. We might now formulate it more generally. When a given situation, a specific law, is in conflict with another law, principle or concern of the Torah, the specific law may be limited in its application, reinterpreted, adapted, suspended, or changed in this one situation, but not abolished by overruling concern, by the overruling concern of the total Torah. We may now be in a better position to understand why the Torah Shebaktav, the written Torah, is not enough, why it needed to be completed by the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral Torah, and why the Halakha could not be anything else but oral teaching. Every written law is somewhat inhumane. As a code laid down for generations, it must express a general idea and an abstract principle of what is right, of what is desired by the lawgiver. But every human situation is specific and not general or abstract. In a sense, every human situation is unique. No general law speaks to the specific situation. The uniqueness of the situation will often call for additional attention by some other principle which has validity within the system. Two witnesses are necessary to establish a fact. The rule has general validity, but the woman whose husband has disappeared is in a specific situation. The law of the Torah itself calls for responsible care for her specific right. Resolution can be found only in the totality of the essence of the law, but no written code can provide the resolution. Once you write it down as the code, you have generalized it. Only the oral Torah, alive in the conscience, this is the important kind of crazy idea, alive in the conscience of the contemporary teachers and masters who can fully evaluate the significance of the confrontation between one word of God and another in a given situation, can resolve the conflict with the creative boldness of application of the comprehensive ethos of the Torah to the case. Thus, Torah Shebaal Peh as halakha, redeems the Torah Shebaktav from the prison of its generality and humanizes it. The written law longs for this, its redemption by the oral Torah. So he says, for him, what is a true halakhic quandary? When I have two Torah values that I think are in equal weight and they, in some ways, conflict, right? Here's another example that he learns from divorce law. In general halakha, to establish a legal fact, we have a presence. We need two witnesses to prove that this thing legally happened. We want to accuse you of stealing, we need to see two witnesses that it happened. We want to testify there's a new moon, we need two witnesses to say that it happened. Two people corroborating the fact says this is a legal fact. We learned this from a pasuk in the Torah. But we have a woman whose husband went on a trip, right? She wants to remarry. It's been 3 years, 4 years, he hasn't returned. We have one person saying, I saw that ship drowned. Every single person died. He's not alive. He's not coming back. Only one person saw it, right? The halakha is willing, in the case of free agunot, to accept only one witness. For him, and this is what's interesting of his understanding, right? We had a Torah verse that said two witnesses you need. And then we have this other thing that's more amorphous. Human need, human situation, human pain, that we want the laws of the Torah to be laws of kindness. And that's another Torah value. And when they head on, the halakha has to make a decision how to balance these two things. In this case, it went for one witness. There are some other sort of extreme examples that he has where he shows that in very sort of extreme one-off situations, we can bend the laws of Torah. And in some ways, his idea is that bending them is really... really protecting them. Here, look at source number 7. He says, whenever there's some evil practice that has to be solved, in a moral situation that has to be eliminated, one may suspend a specific law and institute measures needed to achieve the necessary improvement. This is the meaning of lemigdar milta, to fence a thing, right? He brings examples, some of them are quite extreme, he learns them for the Torah, and him, my grandfather, learning them from Chazal, learning them from Torah, right? How did Eliyahu and Har Komel, how did he how did he make an altar and a sacrifice? After the temple is standing, right after the Mishkan is standing, you're not allowed to do bamot. Violation of a biblical principle, right? But the Gemara there says, you need to fence the thing. To save Torah, the Jewish people were not interested in believing God anymore. He had to do this radical act. that in some ways violated Torah to preserve Torah. Other examples are that he says, when it's necessary to safeguard something of great national or social value, it is a time to act for God, even by disregarding one law or another. Right? Eit lasot l'shem, hifira Torah tefet. It's time to do for God. We can uproot Torah. This is a principle that Chazal use in a number of areas. Specifically that we actually ended up writing down the oral Torah, that we can read from the book of the Haftorah, as opposed to, which you're not supposed to just read excerpts from Torah and have a book with excerpts in it, because it looks like Torah is limited, right? But to expect every community to have all of Nach written out nicely so that they could read the Haftorah was Yeshar. And to do for God so that we could read the parts of the Torah in public, they allowed them to have only one book. Numerous examples like that. And the last one is, for moments or situations of unique significance in the history of the Jewish people, there can be no prescribed law. To acknowledge their meaning and to give them adequate expression, one has to create the law of the hour, hora'at sha'ah. Right? This idea that something is so special or so different that sometimes you need a different ruling. And he learns this here, read this ending here. A discussion brings to mind the saying of Reish Lakish. At times, the abolition of the Torah is its founding. Shebitla shel Torah zehu yosoda. He bases his idea on the midrashic interpretation of God's reference to the shattering of the two tablets that Moses received from Sinai, calls forth by phonetic association of the Hebrew original, the suggestion that God actually approved of Moses' bold deeds. Right? God says about the luchot that Moshe broke. It says he refers to them as the luchot asher shivarta, that which you broke. But asher shivarta, like you could sing asher or ashrecha, is like yasher koat, like ashrecha, like good that you broke, right? That's what Reish Lakish learns that God said, and listen to what he says, right? God actually approved of Moses' bold deed. The daily life and the process of history of people often confronts the teachers of halacha with serious problems of whose solution there could be no precedent. Such is the tragic experience of Moshe, our teacher. While he was still communicating with the divine presence on the mountain in order to receive guidance for the people for all time, the unexpected happened. At a time when their teacher and master was ascending to the ultimate heights of human greatness for their sake, the people below lowered themselves to the degrading worship of the golden calf. How to deal with such a people? How to lead them, in spite of everything, in the ways of Torah and God's commandments? There was no extant answer to such a single event in human history. The solution had to be found outside the received teachings. In that dark hour, Moses, our teacher, was all alone. On him alone rested the responsibility of finding the right response to this frightening event. He shattered the tablets that he had received from God before the very eyes of the fallen people in order to secure the foundations for the Torah. And so he uses this imagery of physically breaking the Torah so that the Torah can be preserved eventually so that they can change their ways. And I think that this sort of image is a model for my grandfather, that sometimes you have to do something radical that appears in some ways to be diverting from what the halakha says, to preserve the halakha. And clearly all these examples show how important the human partnership is in halakha, right? In his philosophy, right? Human beings have a mate. We're talking about common sense and what human need is, right? Who human beings are and the people deciding the halakha are essential, right? And so he says there is a human share in Torah without which halakha would be impossible. A high measure of independence granted to the teachers of Torah, as well as a strong portion of relativism introduced into the interpretation of the word of God revealed at Sinai. However, both are integrated into the very essence of the Torah. That is the ultimate meaning of the statement, also revealed by a Bakal, that these and those are the words of the living God, right? Those were said about both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. It is matter of coordination between the revealed word of God and the human world. The coordination is possible because the word of man, in this case, is a disciple of the revealed one. The teachers of Israel are people who are committed to the Torah from Sinai, who heard the voice, who observed the tradition of Israel's efforts through the ages to render the bequest of the tablets life-guarding and life-forming. When they speak their word in accordance with their understanding, they indeed teach one of the 49 faces of the Torah given to man at Sinai. Okay, so here now we're getting into the part that some of the traditionalists feel very nervous about. And he says, clearly everyone agrees that human beings had a part in Torah, but that when teachers of Torah who've imbibed these principles by learning Torah then apply it to new situations, that is the continuation of the revelation of Torah. Right? He says it here, and he admits that there's a great risk involved in this. Here, if you look at the next verse, it says, according to an opinion in the Talmud, God concluded his covenant with Israel only on account of the oral tradition. Right? The brief between God and Akash Baruch Hu, this is the Gemara in Gittin that my students learned with me this year, was based on the oral Torah. A covenant is a relationship of mutuality. The covenantal relationship could find no expression in the revelation and acceptance of the Torah at Sinai. It was a case, as the Talmud puts it, of kafar alehem har kigi. The law was given, imposed. Only in halakha is the covenant, as mutuality of relationship, fully present. Okay, listen to this next part. The halachicist recognizes the will of God expressed in the Torah. He, or blood, she, is wholly committed to the law and the teaching of the Torah. But in the mutuality of the covenant, the responsibility has fallen to him to take upon himself the risk of determining, in light of the totality of Torah teaching and Torah living, the manner in which the will of the other party to the covenant is to be realized in a specific situation. Ultimately, he has to do that in the independence of his own Torah-imbued conscience. This is our share in the covenant, this existential component of our participation in it. Loyalty to the Torah, to the divine partner to this covenant, demands that we accept the responsibility, notwithstanding the risk involved in the subjective aspect of our participation. Only thus may the generality and abstractness of the written Torah be transformed into Torah Chaim, its realization in whatever situation Jews may find themselves in the course of history. Okay, so he admits there is a big risk involved here. Right? If we say there's a new situation, we have to come up with a new halachic situation, it's very risky. You have to be bold. You have to be willing to take the responsibility upon yourself as a halachic leader and say, I'm going to act. But that is what makes Torah Chaim into a... Torah turns it into a living Torah. Here, we'll read a few more. Look, this next one. He's talking about, we just had a Shemitah year last year, right? And I'm sure you heard about Kruzval, right? You're supposed to forgo all your loans so that they go back to the owner, but there was Hillel, the elder, realized that if we started doing that, people would stop lending. And we have another value that we want people to lend to the poor so they can sustain themselves. So he created, as a tikkun olam, as a fix to the world, this legal, fictional document to some extent that means that the loans will not be forgone. And so my grandfather writes, where did Hillel find the authority for his innovation? I'm on page 7. Where was it written in the Torah? It was, of course, not found in any text, in any code. He found it within himself. There was a clash between equally valid laws, principles, and concerns of the Torah. He had to find a resolution to the conflict. There was no text, no Torah Shvachtav to tell him which course to follow. He could find the solution to the problem within his own understanding of the comprehensive ethos of Judaism, as he was able to gather it in his own heart and it's from his own conscience for the totality of the Torah teaching and the Torah way of life. He brings again the example of the fact that they accepted one witness for women. And if you skip to the end of that text, it says, once again is the authentic halakhic problem situation, where there is the written law in the Bible, but at the time, this time, it is in conflict with another obligation of the Torah to Jew, the care and concern of the woman whose husband has disappeared. Once again, there was no written code to consult. On the basis of the rabbi's understanding of the overriding Torah purpose formulated nowhere explicitly, but absorbed into their own consciousness as the result of a life of dedication and commitment to Torah and its living realization, They gave the answer, a halakhic solution to a halakhic problem. So this is where many people in the Orthodox world felt he had gone far, because it's so risky what he's saying. He's saying they're new situations. How do we know what to do with them? We learn Torah. We inculcate the values of Torah, that we need to care for human need, that we need to use common sense, that we need to be ethical. Not, and of course, if there are cases of psukim that prove of things or if they're mishnayot or whatever, but then we have to act. Then we have to act. And that acting is a responsibility that the halakhic authority can take upon themselves. Here's one of my most painful quotes, but one of my favorite quotes. He says the following. Orthodoxy is, in a sense, halakha in a straitjacket. Having had to transform the oral Torah into a new written one, we have become Karaites to this new Torah Shebichtav. Right? And so this is one of the things that very much frustrated him throughout his life. That he saw this vitality, this flexibility, this true life of Torah in the way it should be applied to new situations. And he felt that we had become straitjacketed, that we were so concerned. Did it say in the Shulchan Aruch? No, it doesn't say it. Oh, the Mishnah Berurah didn't say, then we can't do anything. And that we had, that halakha had become, in a sense, frozen. I think he particularly felt this once the Jewish state was established, and now we had so many new, as a nation, we had to confront so many new things that I think he was a little frustrated that we hadn't come up with better solutions of how to deal with Shemitah and the farmers, or how to deal with what it means to run a hospital. Not that people aren't working on these solutions, but to just say we're going to, you know, only have non-Jews function on the hospital on Shabbat, to him wasn't a halakhic solution to a need of what it means for the Jewish people to live in their own land and need hospitals and work on Shabbat. You're shaking your head, Jan.
No, thank you.
Yeah, it was
great. But I think the word that he used with us all the time is courage.
Courage, yes.
That's the word I hear him say all the time, courage.
Right, it takes a great courage, and because he realizes there's great risk involved. You got to give me, I have 5 to 6 minutes. All right, I don't keep reading text. I just love, to me, he just says it so beautifully, and so I want to read to you his text to me, but I'm going to keep doing it because it's so well. He really was very, very frustrated with this idea that we have become slaves to what was now the written word. And so I'm on page... I'm on page 8 here. He can start in the middle of that first paragraph, but even for me, it's hard for me to read it small. He said, what happened to halakha during, he's saying that in the Galut, because we didn't have so many national problems that we had to solve, we became very focused on these, like, codes. Because of the lack of opportunity for halakhic application to real-life situations of natural existence, the art and wisdom of such application dried up. Because of halacha's exile into literature and codification, new authority barriers were created that seem unsurmountable. The old principle of the acceptance of personal responsibility for halachic decisions, which demanded that the dayan, the judge, rule according to what his eyes see, right, that's a quote from the text, has received new meaning that reads, according to what his eyes see in some authoritative text. Right? The text meant, according to what his eyes see, like what he sees to be the situation, what he sees to be human need. And now it's like, can you quote, does the Tosafot say it, does the Shulchan Aruch say it? It was against such an attitude that the warning of Rabbi Abraham, the son of Maimonides, was directed. Because of its importance, we shall quote it again here. So now he's quoting Rabbi Abraham ben Maimon. The rule of the matter is, say I, that a dayan who in his decision follows only what is written and clearly stated is weak and wanting. Such an attitude invalidates what they, our sages, say. A dayan is guided only by what his own understanding. With him it is not so. What is written are the roots. Every dayan and everyone who gives decisions must weigh them according to each case that comes before him. Every decision that he is considering, he should compare to something similar to it. He should develop branches from the roots. The numerous case histories in the Talmud, which incorporate only part of the laws, were not reported for nothing. Neither were they recorded so that those matters, the law should always be as it is written here. But only so that the wise men, by hearing them often, should acquire efficiency in weighing up matters rationally, as well as good methods in giving decisions. Right? All that was Avram, son of Maimon, right? And then my grandfather continues, it is remarkable that such words should come from the son of Maimonides. They implied an unintended criticism of his father's code, which was meant, as we have seen, to replace all other sources of halakha. Study this and know the law, was the gist of Maimonides' work. In essence, Rabbi Abraham was warning against a new form of Karaism, against becoming Karaites to written down oral Torah. Our present-day halakhic authorities have largely succumbed to that danger. And I think that, that fact was very, very frustrating to him. Should I leave one more thing? Does anyone want to ask a question up to here? We're close to the end. You have a question. Oh, hi, Faustina.
Once he has said this, that
means
what does he still obeys? What does he do?
What do you mean by he obeys? My grandfather was a halachic man. He lived his life based on halacha. I think, meaning on most areas of halacha, not most, but you know, kashrut, Shabbat, when there isn't a moral or ethical question, he's not against following what has been the accepted tradition of Jews for thousands of years. It only is when a new case arises that is really wanting, where he sees pressing human need, that then he feels like the halacha, now we don't just look up what the Mishnah and say, oh, well, the Mishnah didn't say we can't do anything. Right? He feels there the halachicist needs to be bold. And it's not to say yes to everything, but it's to look at what do I see? Do I see, when we do the course, when we do the class on his ideas of solving the Agunah problem, I really think because he saw so many cases where the rabbi said, okay, well, accept one witness instead of two. We won't let, you know, even though Torah law, they should be married or they should be divorced, but because X, Y, and Z would happen in that case, we're not going to do it. He saw a precedent of saying, making sure a woman is free to remarry is a pressing need, and therefore we need to find a solution for her. I don't know in every new situation what solution he would suggest. It clearly would be a solution based on examining the text, based on his knowledge of the text, right? I don't think it's something that's going to be from left field, but it's going to be based on something, but maybe taking it a step further or taking it a step to the side. And that's why I can't give you a clear answer, because it would depend on the situation, the need. And it might even be for one person the answer to be different than another person. That's a good posek, in my opinion, knows who they're talking to, knows what the human need is. And for his whole life, my grandfather was always also a community rabbi. Like, he taught in yeshivot, in institutions, but he had congregants. And I think he was very aware of the needs and the troubles of his congregants. I know there's I heard from the woman herself, a very famous case, right? There's issues in halacha about doing autopsies. Problems with, we don't want to desecrate the human body. There's been, this woman, she kept having, she would get pregnant and boy feet, male fetuses would die. And the doctors knew that there was something genetic going on and they wanted her to autopsy the fetuses. And she went to Sarna Poskim and they wouldn't allow it. But she came to my grandfather and he understood that human need, like she wants, this medical information is going to enable her to have life, right? And the value that, the exact value of why we don't want to do autopsies, by allowing her to do an autopsy in this case, which I think fits this type of case, would, and so he gave her a sock that she could, and they learned, I told the story wrong, they learned after the autopsy that it was a genetic thing linked to male fetuses. And she ended up having, then they, you know, did genetic tests beforehand, and she ended up having three daughters, babies, who are now adult children. But and so that's just an example of, I know, something that played out personally in the lives of his congregants, that then he moved him to write articles on autopsies in halacha, etc. So those are some examples. Okay, I'm coming close. That was your friend. I want to read a few more things, and I know it's late. I'm also tired. I see I'm getting tired because I can't even read these things. I need to get glasses. I've been saying that all year to my students, and I still look at them. So this next paragraph is the last paragraphs of this book that he wrote. He said, I'm on page 89. The methods that teachers and followers of halakhic Judaism have to adopt today is that of persuasion. The task is a twofold one. First, one has to interpret the teaching and its meaning for the searching, questioning, doubting contemporary Jew. This has to be done from the classical sources of Judaism and halakha. The task requires Talmudic scholars of high order, but scholarship is not enough. The scholar has to be familiar with the spirit of the times, understanding its intellectual and emotional preoccupations. Only thus may he be able to meet the challenge of each new day significantly. Secondly, one has to restore halakha to its original function. In struggling with the problems of the day, halakha must once again reveal itself as the wisdom of the feasible, giving priority to the ethical. This requires that the halakha teachers this requires that the halakhic teachers accept personal responsibility for the decisions as the Magen of the Talmud itself. They ought to do so by following the advice of Rabbi Abraham, the son of Maimonides, freeing themselves from all Karaite inclinations, and treating the principles and cases of the Torah Shebaal Peh only as examples, to derive from them the ability to rule in each new case as the Dayan sees with his own eyes. Not only does this method of authority not work, it actually defeats the eternal vitality of the Torah. Right? To just look what... What did I say? Vitality of the Torah, right? By looking in the text and only writing what it says, right? This right actually defeats the eternal vitality of the Torah. Oh my gosh! What do I keep saying? Validity of the Torah. The Torah is eternal because it has a... Good that you're paying attention. I see you're with me still. The Torah is eternal because it has a word for each generation. Every day the Torah should seem as new to you as it has been given on that day, said the Midrash. One can find the word that has been waiting for this hour to be revealed only if one faces the challenge of each new situation in the history of the generations of Israel and attempts to deal with it in intellectual and ethical honesty. Alas, those who have the authority to impose laws of the Torah do not care to understand the nature of the confrontation with the, how do I pronounce this? Zeitgeist. They write, which is the spirit of the day. They take the easy way out. They do not search for the word that was intended for this hour, for this generation. If they have the authority, they impose the word meant for yesterday, and thus mishearing the word that the eternal validity of the Torah was planning for today, for this generation, for this new hour in the history of the Jewish people. Right? It's very powerful, right? For him, for Torah to be true and to be eternal, you have to see what's going on now and apply to the situation now. If you say, well, this is what they said 100 years ago and try to apply it to now, that's not live eternal Torah. The last thing I keep saying on the last that I want to end with is, I think, unfortunately, a lot of people... Not a lot of people. People said, oh, he's not from, right? He's not Orthodox. He doesn't, how could he say these things about the changing of time? But what I noticed in his writings is that, from what I saw, it actually is his deep, strong faith in the truth and eternalness of Torah that enabled him to say these things. This quote to me is so powerful. This I found after his death. We found some of the correspondence he had with the Sri Deish, with his teacher. And so he's actually talking here about a solution for Agunot. I know it's in Hebrew, but I'm going to read it first in Hebrew because it's so powerful. He says, Ani ma'amin be'emunah shlema shiyesh pitaron mipnei she'ani ma'amin. I believe with all my heart, right, with complete and utter faith, that there is a solution because I believe. Mipnei she'ani ma'amin be'elohei Yisrael u'betorato, Ani ma'amin gam ken b'kocho ha'etan v'hanitzchi shel halacha liftor et ha'bayot ha'ovrot al chayei Am Yisrael. Because I believe in the God of Israel and in God's Torah, I believe also in the power and the strength, the power and the eternal strength of the halacha to liftor, to solve. You don't need my chair. So to solve the challenges that pass on the lives of Israel, right? Meaning, because he believes the Torah is true, because he believes the Torah is eternal, it can't be that there's not a solution for some pressing human need. Yes?
It's all very attractive. The quotes from the Talmud that he gave, say, two, is a general statement which then stands. But what he's now saying is, a rabbi himself, with his congregation, has to be in a particular situation. That is only authoritative, presumably, that rabbi in that situation, in that community, so no longer we can't. He's actually more revolutionary by saying, in fact, any qualified authority, even what that means, Dayan, gives a ruling for his situation in his time. We trust him to be like your grandfather.
Correct.
So he's actually more revolutionary, simply saying, apply it to your time. He's saying there is no international, or even national, or even a code of applying. And I give an example, I don't want to raise this now, I just said it. So it's okay to interpret the law in the way he did, but supposing the laws of Shabbat, which you say he was a strong man. Somebody who is unable to walk says, I need to travel because I need to be to Daven with a minyan on Shabbat. I'm not saying what the answer should be for that, but it seems a rabbi could apply, following his principles here, a rabbi, even an Orthodox rabbi, believing exactly the same principles he applies here, could give an answer to that question, which is different to a rabbi in another community. I mean, that seems to be what you're saying.
Yes and no. But what I want to understand, I really think that what he means when he says like that you have a Torah-imbued conscience is that you are very versed in the halakha, right? You know what the rabbis of the time period of the Mishnah said. You know what the rabbis of the time period of the Gemara said, what they felt for this. And you read all the response of all the generations on that particular issue that are relevant so that you could see what some of the values are, what some of the pressing, right? You don't just say from left field, oh, he needs to walk. Okay, he walks. You might say, I don't know what he would answer. But right, we could talk about the fact that there are differences of opinion about what electricity is and if it's violating Shabbat. And certain types of electricity only violate, let's say, maybe a rabbinic idea. So for the average Jew, we're not going to go around saying, no problem, turn on your incandescent lights because they're not even close to what the circuits of a regular light bulb are. We're not going to say that because there's no more problem. You can have your Shabbos Chana. But maybe we'll allow him to use X, Y, and Z wheelchair, I don't know what, I don't know how they work, that might be only violating rabbinic commandment. That's what I would look towards because I have a value. But I would look at if anyone else is writing this response. And then once I do it, I mean, he didn't write everything. He didn't write a book of responses, but I might publish my thought. So then you and your community, when you're answering it, might look at me. And if you think that the word that I said for today is still the word for your today, you could apply it. So I think that's how halakha has actually always been. In fact, we're most straitjacketed now. Look at the response for generations on any issue, right? New things happen all the time. We found solutions, we addressed them. I don't think it means that always the answer has to be yes. But I think we should be motivated to try, when it's a real situation of human need, like what you said, this person is going to be, because we live so far away now and you have to travel, that's a real human need, that halakha should have an answer to find a way to enable a person to feel part of a community on Shabbat. And there should be a way to find a halakha solution for it. I think also Tzomet is working on a similar thing with wheelchairs. I wanted to just say, I have two other quotes here, you should just, about this belief in Torah. I'll read the last sentence of force number 14. He said, what is needed is not less dedication to halakha, but more faith in halakha. Where there is greater faith, the greater boldness is justified. And I'll read 15. But again, one might ask, have all the explanation of what is possible within the law already been given? What does not ask these questions because the Torah has become a burden and one wishes to break away from it. One asks because one believes in the internal vitality of the divine revelation, because one is committed with one's whole existence to the proposition that the teaching is Torah Chaim, the way of life of the Jew. So, good night. Next week we'll talk about the status of women within halakha having to do with Jewish ritual.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.